or private clouds. So I'm showing a number of Eucalyptus private clouds, and I'm showing the public clouds that they can run on. And you choose where you run your applications. You choose what users you serve. That's, roughly speaking, the technical landscape in which we operate. So with that, let's go back to the topic. Thanks for turning on the audio. But I think the audience has been hearing me all the time. So the big thing here, the thing that causes all of these changes that we see today, in my mind, has to do with scale, that we have such big numbers of everything now. If you go back thousands of years, human beings would live in small tribes and small villages. They didn't need Facebook. They didn't need LinkedIn. They didn't need phones. They needed none of that because they were very local and very social with each other, and they knew exactly what was happening. So they had probably even more information about each other than we have today through the social networks. But they didn't need any devices to help them get there. And the same then with... But now as we have so many people, we need tools to do that. And we see a similar trend with computers, where initially, you know, the world created computers, we loved our servers, we even gave names to them. In traditional data centers, you have a name for each server in the data center. It doesn't happen anymore. There's so many servers, so many nodes in a server room, that you just can't deal with them that way. So you have a situation where the scale has changed. We have so many more of them that you have to figure out new methods of dealing with it. And this has been, I think it's an important realization that when something grows and it scales, you can't use the same systems or the same architectures anymore. You must figure out a new way, completely new way of dealing with it. And we all know from horror movies these giant insects that come and eat you and kill you. Well, insects don't scale. Physically, you cannot take an ant and grow it 1,000 times and think that it will work. It just physically doesn't work. The legs won't carry it. Because if you scale an ant 1,000 times, you'd have to scale the legs 1,000,000 times. And then they're so thick that they can't move. So that just serves to show that when the scales change, when you move into a higher dimension of something, when there's a 10 times more or 100 times more or 1,000 times more of something, you must figure out completely new ways of dealing with it. And that's what we are seeing now in IT, where cloud computing and the way you take care of your servers and provision compute power must change because we have so many of them. So here's the same idea here on this slide, that as it grows, you must figure out new ways. And what looked as a small thing or a big thing in a small environment, when it scales, suddenly it's a small thing in a big environment. And you just must figure out and must come up with completely new models and methods. So here's one example. This is Facebook version 1 or something, Rolodex. So when, you know, just 10, 20, 30 years ago, or maybe 40 years ago, in business, when we had contacts, we used Rolodexes. We had these index cards where we wrote down the name of our business contacts and the address and the telephone number, and we kept them sorted in those boxes and those rollers where we could find them. That was how we dealt with business contacts back then, and it worked well. And even today, therefore, people say, I have a large Rolodex, meaning I have many friends or I have many business contacts. But now, with this many friends, it's just completely impossible. There's no way you could sit there with small paper cards for each of your friends and making small updates when they saw a movie or they liked something or they posted their vacation photos or something. There's no way you can do it. You must start using social networks. You must automate it. You must build self-governing systems that can take care of it for you because there's just no way you could do it. And this now happens on Facebook, and not just on Facebook. When I say Facebook, I mean any social network. There's Facebook, there's LinkedIn, there's Google+, there's Orkut, there's Zing, there's Mixi, there's Cyworld, there's Kontakte, there's StudiVZ. There's an endless number of them. Most of them run on MySQL, the database. That's how I happen to know them. But you still, inside Facebook or whatever the social network is, you have the same functionality still. You have the same Rolodex cards, just that everybody is maintaining them themselves, and you get the benefit of seeing them. So here's another example. Containers. Again, a situation where scale forced mankind to come up with a new method, a new system of dealing with them. We used to ship goods just individually packed and individually taken care of. We had smaller ships, we had trucks, and we had, or mostly trains back then. But then somebody realized that to really scale this, we must go to a new level. We must standardize the way we do shipping. And the metal shipping container was defined in the 50s. And it made a huge impact on the whole world in terms of trade and logistics and being able to build ships that are container ships that are specifically designed to carry them, ports that are specifically designed to deal with them, trains and trucks, everything built for it. And suddenly shipping goods around the world became much cheaper. We could go to a much higher volume, was much easier. So, and I'm saying this because it applies to today's world as well. If you see the steel container as a human being, then you could claim that this is Facebook. It's a collection of a lot of these standardized items. And they're standard in size, so they're easy to stack and pile and transport. But inside, they're all unique. Every steel container has its own content. And we have the same thing on social networks, where we have a standard profile structure where we fill in our information, but all information is unique to ourselves. And it is the same with cloud computing. That's also Amazon Web Services. That's what they do. A huge ship with standardized units that can serve you, and they take you to new destinations with the Amazon cloud. And previously, that just wasn't conceivable. Just as for those in the shipping industry, nobody would believe that containers could work. They said, no, why would you have waste money on building steel containers? They take up so much space, they weigh so much, and all our goods and products are individual. We just can't do this. But they did it, and it really propelled the world. So if that's a public cloud, then here you have a private cloud as an analogy. So you can take those containers and you drive around with it yourself. You own it, you control it, you can do whatever you like with it. Or you can bring them together, put them on the big ship, and you have a collection of them. But they're standardized. There's a definition of the API, meaning how it relates to the rest of the world. You know exactly how large they are. You know exactly how to lift them, how to transport them, how to move them. And still, there are variations in them. You have air-conditioned containers. You have cold containers, and so on. But the size is the same. The API is standard. So I think it's a question of, generally, of going from a system where you optimize for perfection to a system where you optimize for scale. And typically, as we design new things, we start by going for perfection. We build a perfect single unit of something. And that's how most things emerge. At some point, we get so many of them that we need to shift over and focus on scale. And we lose some perfection there. And I think that's what's happening in cloud computing, in social networks. As you go from the traditional models to the scalable models, there's a loss of perfection, but it scales much better. Meaning, to take the analogy from social networks, if you don't use Facebook or LinkedIn, you deal with every human being as a complete individual and you send them Christmas cards and handwritten letters, sure, you have much higher perfection. You probably have a closer relationship to the person. But boy, does it take time. If you have 1,000 contacts, how do you send personal letters to them all? You know, it doesn't scale. And then when you say, okay, I'll switch over to a social network, suddenly you can blast the whole world with your greetings and everything. And some will feel that it's a little bit impersonal, but it also scales. And you can keep in touch with many, many more people. You can be aware of what's happening in the world much faster with much broader groups. And we see the same in cloud computing, where we used to treat every server as an individual. Like I said, we gave them a name. They have an IP address, but we also gave them names, and we took care of them, and we polished them, and we, you know, we looked at them, and we, they were individually treated. We configured them individually. And sure, we got a higher level of perfection for that specific unit, but just completely impossible today to do with the growth we see in computing. So you have to go for a scalable system, and you lose some perfection. Additionally, there is, and that's the arc here on the slide, there's sort of a state of the art, the best way of doing things at any given time. So of course we are trying to maximize both perfection and scale, and there's a frontier at how far we've come there. And I'm arguing here that the traditional models in between human beings is less efficient, so it's inside the arc, it's inside what's possible, and the new social networks is taking the efficiency to a new dimension. So they're expanding the arc and increasing both perfection and scale, but increasing scale more than perfection. And we'll probably see in the future how it expands even more. We see some new disruption that disrupts social networks because there's an even smarter way of doing things, and we don't know yet what it is. And this same thing applies to servers, computers, storage, networking, the hardware side of it. Less seriously, you could say that this is also the source of all contention between the United States and Europe, because Europe always focuses on perfection and says, yes, everything is bigger in the U.S., but it's not as good. And in the U.S., everybody says, well, everything is big here, and we don't mess with those small details. And there's a certain truth to that, that some things lend themselves to scaling, and some things lend themselves to perfection. So when it comes to design and cosmetics and food and wine, you might take the European path and go for perfection only with no scale. But when you do business, when it's about social networks, when it's about computers, high tech, IT, then scale is the way to go, because that's how you get to the efficiencies. And over time, I argue that even with scale, you reach quality, although initially you may see a degradation of it. I'm a believer in the notion that quantity creates quality in certain areas, in high tech specifically. And this goes against what many have been taught by their mothers, who said always, you know, quality over quantity. But when it comes to things you can duplicate easily, actually, quantity many times results in quality. And we see this in open source very much, where you have a huge community of users and contributors and people who complain about your software, file bug reports. There, quantity ultimately results in quality. Open source software is higher quality than closed source. Not that there's any single smarter person working on it, but because there are so many people there. So here's an example of the scale we are now talking about. In 2015, we'll have 15 billion connected devices. So devices with an IP address. Phones, iPads, Kindles, laptops, medical devices, gas meters, servers, anything. 15 billion of them. And we'll have 3 billion connected human beings. So about half the world population will be on the internet in just a few years. This is huge. How many people were on the internet in the dot-com boom in 99 and 2000, 2001? 300 million? That was the size of the whole internet back then, and it created all those businesses. Today, we soon have 3 billion people on the internet, and it's growing. We will soon, then a few more years after 2015, we'll have 4 billion. And this is what forces us to rethink how we deal with all these connected human beings, and for companies like us to think how we deal with all these devices. There's so many of them. There's no way of managing them individually anymore. So how do you know that this is a social network and not a compute cloud? You don't. This could be a picture of your friends, you and your friends. There's the country you're from, and your college buddies, and your neighbors, and all in different colors. But it could also be a computer cloud. This could be a set of servers somewhere that are connected to each other. Maybe they are specialized in storage and networking, and that's the different colors. There are lots of similarities between social networks and and human being servers, sorry, and compute clouds. But at the same time, computers are not human beings. So I've now argued that there's lots to learn from social networks in how we manage compute clouds. But let me state that I do not believe that computers are human. I don't believe computers have a soul. I don't believe computers will ever behave like humans. Thank God. It would be bad if they did. So there's something we can learn, but not everything. And computers can learn to be outsmart human beings. They can win them in chess. They can remember more information. They probably even can figure out emotions in some way. But I still don't think that they are the same. So here's one reason. Human beings gossip a lot. And if we are techies, we think that gossiping is bad. But it could actually be that gossip is the connecting tissue that keeps things going. It's sort of the essence of a social network. It's the essence of an interaction. And I just read a book where they claim that gossip is the reason we have language. The author claimed that every animal, every mammal gossips about. They need to figure out, you know, who's in, who is out, who's strong, who is weak, who is hungry, who is not. And human beings, just because there were more of them in a group, had to develop a more scalable way of doing this. So they developed language. So maybe that was a similar shift, that from small groups, like if you observe lions or chimpanzees or other mammals, they're in small groups and they can figure out the gossip without saying anything because physically they can do it. Human beings got together, there were 50 or 150 people in a group. The only way to really stay on top of it was to develop a language. So they started gossiping. And so they say, hey, how about this guy? Why is he angry today? And is she not doing well? And how about and that's how you start managing the group. And now we see a similar shift when we go into social networks, where you do that by clicking like and dislike, perhaps, and you're commenting to each other. And so the question here then is, if it's true that gossip is this, the way of knowing the state of the system, how can computers gossip? Could they do that? And I think they can. I think servers produce a lot of signals all the time, and we are now teaching them to read each other's signals. So there are log files, you can ping them. There are things that are looking, start to look like gossip, where servers in a server farm, in a compute cloud, can know the state of their buddies so that they know who is hungry and who is not, who is thirsty, who is tired, who has slow response times, who doesn't, who has still some storage space and who doesn't. And I believe that by letting the computers figure that out on their own, the system can start to scale. Because when you build scalable systems, they must be autonomous. They cannot be dependent on a single controlling place. They must operate on their own and be autonomous and self-governing. And I believe there's something here in this gossiping that's important to compute clouds. The other very important thing is reputation. Nearly everything human beings do is based on reputation and trust. We may not think about it, but that's how it works. When we use a credit card, it is because somebody trusts you in having credit on the credit card. You have a reputation. That's why there's a logo and a brand name on the credit card, because the reputation gives the seller the confidence in selling something to you and believing that there's money coming back. And it's the same in social networks, where you create reputation networks by liking, by commenting, by befriending and defriending. It creates reputation. And you know that if somebody who is maybe three steps away buys a certain product, then you know, okay, could be a reasonably good product because the friend of a friend of a friend just bought it. So you get a very strong mechanism for scaling this through reputation, and it's self-governed and autonomous. The reputation isn't controlled by a single entity, but everybody creates it themselves. So the question is then, how do you do reputation in a compute cloud? How do you know which servers are trustworthy? How do you know that they don't have viruses? And that's an area in development today in software. I don't think we are nearly done there yet, but we are learning how to make computers understand from each other what the reputation is. Open source, again, is a great mechanism here, because we know that an open source license in itself conveys reputation. And we know who wrote the code. And we have code repositories where we can verify where the code came from. And we know that it wasn't stolen, it isn't bad code, because it's open and others have seen it. And linked to reputation is relevance. Meaning, how do you know, with so much stuff, how do you know what's relevant? Like back to the shipping containers. How do you know which containers are relevant? Which ones are for you? Which ones should go on what ship? And they use a coding system for showing it, and you have computers keeping track of each container. In a social network, relevance is very much conveyed through the connections that you have and the number of likes or the number of clicks or something like that, and you know what you need to pay attention to. And in Facebook, you can adjust the relevance. You can say, from a certain friend, I want all updates, the most important updates, or no updates. And that's how you adjust the relevance experience that you have. And we have the same in compute clouds, where some servers are more relevant for certain needs, and the system needs to understand where it can get access to them, how it can deploy new applications, which ones are relevant and which ones aren't. And when you scale this to thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of nodes, it becomes a very difficult challenge. But and you need the reputation and the relevance to be able to manage them. So that's how we then, I hope, we'll come to something like software civilizations, where by this I mean a world where software can manage itself, where software has rules and policies, they have laws they follow, and where software is aware of itself. And an example is with the Eucalyptus cloud platform, you can manage it. We have management tools for the cloud, but all tools are also available in a scriptable API manner, so you can have software manipulating the cloud. And this is a step towards creating software civilizations where the application itself can adjust and configure its own environment, which is one of the benefits we're now seeing with cloud computing. When you're spinning up a new instance, you're spinning up a new virtual machine. In a traditional world, software developers lived in whatever environment they had. Maybe their CIO, if it's a large organization, dictate that this is the environment, this is the operating system, these are the tools we use. Today, in cloud environments, when you can spin up your own virtual machine, you can build the universe you need there. You can dictate the operating system, the hypervisor, the databases, and the versions of them. And you can assemble them there and run them for your own application. And the next door developer who is developing something else, he is not dependent or influenced by your choices. He can build his own universe. So you start to see these independent chunks of code, the images that run on clouds that can maintain their own world and manipulate their own world so that they can form what I call software civilizations, where you have applications, they can work together, they have rules how they work together, they can define their underlying software environment, and they're detached from hardware. They are not dependent on the hardware itself, because the cloud abstracts away the difficult details of hardware, and hardware is three types, compute, storage, and networking. So there could be a future where applications interact in this way, where we develop them, we set the rules, we have foreign policy, we have rules, we follow the rules. If we don't follow the rules, we kill the application, and we can orchestrate this through the cloud. And this is, you know, just a small part of it. This is what it looks like today. But 10 years ago, we didn't have this many applications. But with all the mobile devices today, the number of applications is just exploding. There are hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of new applications out there, and they all have their own requirements, their own dependencies. But by letting them define their own environment, you can scale the system. You can scale it without it becoming unmanageable. So I think it will as we move in this direction, well, the effects that it will have for developers is that this frees the applications and the application developer in a way we haven't seen before. So back to my history at MySQL, we always talked about the LAMP stack, L-A-M-P, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, Perl, Python. Back then, when you built a website like Facebook, when Mark Zuckerberg built Facebook, he built it on the LAMP stack. We had stacks back then. Today, we don't have stacks anymore. We have large mashups or ensembles or collections. A single web service today will typically use many databases. There's MySQL, there's SQLite, there's Memcached, there's Sphinx, there's MongoDB, there can be a Hadoop installation. They are sitting next to each other, not on top of each other, and they're all individually designed. So that today on Amazon, there's about 10,000 machine images ready to go. People who have assembled different pieces of mostly open source code into images that you can use. So the world of the stacks, it's not about the LAMP stack anymore because there's so much variety. But you can each create your own combination for your own world, and you can keep it alive for as long as your application is live, and then you can let it go. And that's what I mean with the software multiverse, that you really have reached a new level of independence there. You spin up a virtual machine, you build the environment there, you pick the Linux versions you need, and you put it together, run your application, and no matter how the world changes around you, you can keep running that specific image and application for as long as you need. So it's a way of preserving the state that you need for the application you have. Instead of what we have today, when we're in the banking and insurance sector, we have some old applications that by law have to be kept alive. So there's still software running on old mainframes and DOS machines because it's something that was written in the 70s or 80s. So that's why I'd call it a multiverse, meaning multiple different universes that are largely independent of each other. And then the amazing thing today in the cloud is that you can deploy your applications on any virtual machine. That virtual machine may be purchased from Amazon by the hour, or it may run on your own private cloud, and the application won't know and won't care. You decide where you deploy it. And this is an amazing freedom from the hardware that we didn't used to have. I remember going into lots of data centers where the admin proudly shows that here's the server that runs our website, and here we run our HR, and that's the ERP system, and each server had a specific purpose, and they were closely linked. Today, that's not the case. You develop an application, and you can deploy it anywhere. And similarly, the user access, the human being using the application, they are freed as well. Because today, when you use an application, you can be on a smartphone, you can be on your iPad, you can be on your laptop. You have a number of different end-user devices, connected devices that you use to access the phone. And the form factor determines what you can do. If it's small, of course, you can't see a big screen. If it's a big one, you have different tools available. But it's the same application. And this is, of course, a complication for developers. So when I'm saying it's freeing the apps and making life easy for the developers, the fact that we have so many different devices and different form factors means that it's more complicated for you because you need to build an iPhone app and an Android app and a Nokia app, and then it needs to run on your regular browser and you need to support all the different browsers. So that's a complication for you, but it makes life easier for users. And then finally, I believe that whereas in the last 10 to 20 years, we've very much focused on making source code open. So the whole movement with Linux and open source and free software was about making the source code open, available, accessible to all. Today, when we are building a new world in the cloud and on a cloud infrastructure, we must pay equal attention to APIs and data. Because in the cloud, many times the service is hidden somewhere. It's abstracted away. And whether the code is open or not may not be relevant to you. What may be more relevant is whether the API, the interface, is well-defined and whether you can always trust it. And thirdly, sometimes it's about data. Is the data truly open? like on the social networks, do you have a right to download a copy of all the data you have there? And can you download a copy and erase it in the social network? Do you have ownership of your own data? And it's not clear today. On some networks it is, but some aren't. And you, when you sign the license terms, when you sign up for a new service, whoever reads those texts? 5 pages on all, of all kinds of onerous terms and conditions that you have no understanding of. So there's a risk that just as we got the code secured as open and the open source movement being very successful, now we need to do the same with APIs and with data, because that's how the cloud operates. So in summary, what's the similarity between friends and computers, you know, social networks and clouds? Well, they're always available and accessible, and that's a change. If you think back on a time in your life or in mankind's life where we didn't have phones and social networks, your friends were not necessarily always available and accessible. You had to walk over to them or jump on your bike and go and visit them to connect with them. Today, you connect with them all the time on the social networks. And the same with servers, with computers and compute clouds. And they're connected with each other, so they share information one-on-one, information that this big system doesn't necessarily know, but that those two or those three or the group knows. So there's the sharing of preferences, that the stuff that amounts to reputation between the different human beings or the different servers. And then the difficult one, I wrote caring and sharing. I'm not sure computers care about each other. You know, human beings do. But in a compute cloud, do our servers really care about each other? No. They share. They do share stuff with each other. So you can have, let's say you have a cloud with 1,000 nodes or 5,000 nodes, and then you add 100 new servers. The goal is to make sure that the existing cloud does the onboarding of the new ones. So you just tell the cloud, here are 100 more servers. Can you please configure them for your needs? That's a way of sharing. It doesn't work yet in compute clouds, but we are getting there. So that sort of sharing works. But would they really care? No, that's probably a stretch. I would hope that we could make them care, meaning in a compute cloud where you have adjacent servers and one realizes that the other one is having a failure, that it can volunteer to take over the workload or disconnect it or do something like that. That's sort of caring in a technical sense. But like I earlier said, I do not believe that human beings are computers or computers are human beings. So you can take the analogy only so far. And then through this, you get to scalable networks. You get systems that scale on their own because they are based on reputation. They are based on dividing the big challenge into small challenges that each node, each computer, each human being can work on. And that's what makes it scale. That's how we can have 3 billion people on the internet. And that's how the internet works in itself. It's a massively distributed system where there's no single point of failure, no single point of control. And that is how you create highly, highly scalable systems. So that, let me stop here and take questions from you, questions from the audience. I'm happy to take questions on anything you like, the topics I discussed or others, more technical or more business-oriented. And if you want your questions to be heard on the podcast, then you need to use the microphone in the middle. But I will hear you no matter what.
Yeah, I'm curious how much Eucalyptus uses private cloud versus public cloud. Like, how do you do your software development? You know, and how much do you do in-house, not using the cloud?
Yep, good question. So how much does Eucalyptus use public and private clouds? So because we develop software that goes deep, deep, deep in the infrastructure, you know, I've talked here about how easy everything is in the cloud, we do the difficult part of it. So we need to have servers very close to ourselves. So we run it on our own. We have an internal cloud with about 500 nodes right now. And we have some of them co-located, the main development center is in Santa Barbara. Some are co-located in Los Angeles, and it's too far away. Because some of our developers, when they test the software, they need to configure on the lowest bare metal level, and they need to have access with very low latency. So that's why we run most of our servers in our office, so we can be very efficient in the development of the software. Then when we test, we go out broader and we test elsewhere. And the Eucalyptus 3 release that just got ready was tested. We installed it and tested it 15,000 times before we released it. So we do a lot of that testing, but most of it is in-house. But you shouldn't take that to mean anything for you, meaning we test it on our servers so that for you it will be a private cloud, or you can run on a public cloud and you don't need to worry about it. But we are deep in that plumbing. There's a question.
I'm from IEEE, and we're developing some cloud standards, and one of them is intercloud communications. And I'm not an expert in this area, but there seems to be, once you're like with your platform, are customers locked in to your platform for, you know, duration if they wanted to move, you know, to another platform? How would that work? You know, where is the interoperability, I guess, is my question.
Yeah.
You can move from Amazon to Microsoft to, you know, another cloud provider, but you go through your software, right? So that the customers are locked into your software. If they decide to move to another software provider, it has to be redone, or, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm not sure how the interoperability works.
Yep, great question. So the question was about lock-in in the Eucalyptus software. Well, it specifically is designed to not make lock-in, but on the contrary, free you from lock-in, because there are many other solutions that lock you in. So the way we've done it is, number one, as I mentioned, we follow the same API as Amazon does in their cloud, which means that whatever runs on Amazon runs on Eucalyptus, and whatever runs on Eucalyptus runs on Amazon. So let's say you are running on Eucalyptus and you feel you should stop doing it. You can easily move to Amazon and without changes, keep going on Amazon without any change. So that's one level of freedom. And there are other cloud platforms as well who use the same API. So I think there's complete freedom there. And that's very important. You mentioned that somebody could move from Amazon's cloud to Microsoft or vice versa. I don't think it's doable. Amazon's Azure and AWS are so different that moving between them is a difficult task. So you are locked in, essentially, to the API. But we follow the most common API, and others do as well. So that's one level. The other level of freedom is that we support all major hypervisors. So it's a technical detail, but it does give you freedom, because whether you run on VMware's hypervisor or whether you use KVM or Xen, you can mix and match them in the Eucalyptus environment, and so you're not locked into any of them either, which also gives you at the same time freedom from hardware, freedom from lock-in with hardware. And then thirdly, our product is open source code, which means that there's never a lock-in. You can take the code, you can modify it for your own purposes. You don't need to use us as a vendor. You don't need to pay us money. You can just use the product. And many do. Like when I mentioned USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they never paid us a dime. They downloaded the code. They figured out how it works, installed it, and got going. And then we heard about it. And we are very proud of them as a reference customer, but we've never sold them anything. And you say, why would you do that, Martin? Aren't you a businessman? And I'm saying that is the value of open source, that when people use our product free of charge, we benefit from it. We get a good reference customer. We get people who know the technology. We get bug reports and fixes that we otherwise wouldn't get. And that propels our business. And we believe that there's always in the world those people who will spend a lot of time in order to save money, and the government is one of them, and others who are ready to spend money in order to save time. And that's how an open source business model works. Those who need to save time will spend money, and that's the business, and the others will spend time and learn the product, write blogs about the product, books about the product, fix bugs, and so on. So yes, so back to your question, three ways of avoiding lock-in. We follow the common API, we support all major hypervisors, and the product is open source.
Hey there. on the topic of open source, you mentioned your open API push, but when you look at social networks, the idea of open data, isn't that their product? Will they ever be willing to share all that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Would a social network ever open up their data? And, you know, I believe in freedom, so I think they should. Will they? I don't know. But I'm thinking of the analogy, again, of banks. Why do we keep our money in a bank? Because we know we can withdraw it at any time. You just go to the bank and say, give me my money back. And because you know you can do it, you don't have to do it. If you ever fear that your bank cannot pay you back your money or give you your money, you would immediately go there and withdraw it. And that's what happens in countries with bad banking systems. So the lock-in of a bank is in its openness, in the fact that it's open. So I'm hoping that with social networks and other web services, the player will win that offers you the most freedom. And I would certainly do so. If I have a choice of web services and there's one that says, Martin, if you come in here, we will always let you take your data out. We'll always let you do whatever you do. You own the data. I would use that system more than another one. But then I must realize that maybe I'm a minority and maybe most people don't care about it. They just care about the cool APIs or the cool user interface and where their friends are. So, you know, who knows where control will be. But that's why I think it's a very important topic. And by discussing it, we already raise the awareness and we get people to think twice about what they use.
Hi, listening to you talk about software civilization was a bit of a moment for me. It's kind of, that's the next thing. The Matrix doesn't really come into it. It seems like it's the next thing. And twinning that with the number you mentioned of the 15 billion connected devices just started me thinking about the variations in the software that is running on all of those devices and the variations in all the other things that are around it. And I'm just as a question, I'm wondering, I know this is a software platform, mm-hmm. but do you see that one at some point, some in the future, that there's a hardware solution to this software civilization, i.e. there's a potential for a chip that would enable any device to then talk to any other device in a meaningful way. So you abstract out all the software worries into some kind of a hardware-based chip that does those communications for you across your devices. Just a great
question and a relevant one. So generally, I think that the delineation between hardware and software is to some degree philosophical, meaning some things you don't know whether they are hardware or software. And I think over time we'll see more and more software be pushed down into hardware. And for instance, people predict that the hypervisors will very soon be a feature of the processor, not a piece of software. So I think that's happening. But I do not believe that hardware can solve, generically hardware can solve what software is doing. The great thing with software is that it's completely customizable. So when you have a piece of software, you can configure it to your needs and your desires. And hardware doesn't have that. Or if hardware has it, it's thanks to software. And I believe that as we create a software civilization, human beings and other devices, they will need to have highly customized pieces of something. The communication will be customized. And they're like human beings have different languages, I think software will have express similar behavior. So that's why I don't think hardware will solve it specifically. But sure, every improvement in hardware makes it easier to do these things because the hardware will understand the different communication protocols and sort of have more packed into it. But still, I believe it's a software solution. But then I'm biased. I'm a software guy. I'm not a hardware guy. So you need to ask the hardware guys, and they may respond completely in the opposite. They may say software is here just to serve hardware, and without hardware, nothing will work, which is true as well. Great. There's a question.
Yeah. So there's two questions, actually. So at the beginning, you mentioned that some of these companies are starting off their game in the public cloud, then pushing it back into the private cloud,
Yeah. Which
is kind of like the opposite strategy of cloud bursting.
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
So when companies decide where to put workloads, they can put them in the private or in the public cloud or in both. And we've seen so many different constellations that we don't have, there's no one model that fits them all. This particular case of starting again out there, why do they launch it in the public cloud? For one reason, they don't know how popular it will be. So they throw it out in the public cloud and it can scale. They can get 10 million users or one user and they will have the elasticity for it. So that's why they go there. Then when the workload settles, why do they move back in? There are financial reasons. They can operate their own cloud at lower cost than what it costs to buy the same service. And they can get better performance because their own cloud is customized and configured for specifically for games. When you buy compute services from a public cloud vendor, you get the standard. It's like going to Starbucks. You know, you can only buy the certain cup sizes and the certain products that they sell. You cannot get a customized coffee. Well, maybe you can today, but in the cloud you get what they have. Yeah. But in the private you get what you configure.
Again, the second question is more about Eucalyptus and comparing Eucalyptus to some of the other open source cloud platforms.
Yep.
Like Iron Foundry or CloudStack.
Uh-huh.
How do they compare?
So there are, I don't know Iron Foundry actually, but I know of four open source private cloud software platforms. So you have Open Nebula in Spain. You have Eucalyptus. These were the two original ones that came both from research projects. Then you have what is now called CloudStack, used to be called Cloud.com, is owned by Citrix. And then you have OpenStack, which is Rackspace's project. So those four. All of these are open source, so that you have four to choose between. We stand out in our strategy to follow the Amazon API. So we just think that whatever our emotions are, Amazon is the dominant public cloud vendor today. They have 80 or 90% of the market. So we think their APIs are becoming a de facto standard, whether we like it or not. So we should follow them. The others do not follow that API. So that's a major difference. Then, technically, when you look at our products, we have more of a focus at Eucalyptus on solving really hard computational problems. And we are not famous for the nicest tools or graphical user interfaces. Whereas there are other products where they have been very successful in building self-provisioning web tools and stuff that look good. We will do that over time, but right now when you compare the products, you'd probably see a difference there. We just implemented high availability into Eucalyptus, and it's a very difficult feature to build. Nobody else has done it, and we did that instead of building some more bells and whistles-like features. So that's how I would compare. But, it's open source. Download it, test it, get going.
It works. Thank you.
Two more minutes. So one more question, if there's any. This is amazing. This is an audience where more than 50% asked the question. I love this. I wouldn't trade it for anything. So you've been a wonderful audience here today. Feel free to stay in touch. If you're interested, join our community, contribute code, bug fixes, and everything. And I hope you are enjoying South by Southwest. Thank you for getting up very early on a Sunday morning. I think that's amazing. Or maybe you didn't go to sleep. I don't know which category you belong to. But thank you very much, and I'll be available for further discussions if you have any. Thank you.